This is Audible.
It's Christmas.
Penguin Audio presents I'm Dreaming of a Black Christmas, written and read by Lewis Black. Fuck that. Introduction. The uplifting and heartfelt story of how this book came to be. No, your eyes are not deceiving you. This is a book about Christmas, or the holiday season if you're deranged enough that you have to call it that, written by your old friend, the essence of the Christmas spirit, Mr. Mirth himself, me. How did this come to pass? How did this glorious miracle occur? What star in the east was seen by yours truly that inspired him to write this book? Well, now, there's a story. Every memorable Christmas story has its beginnings in the yearnings of the heart. Not mine, of course, but somebody else's. I have naps to take, after all. In truth, dear listener, it wasn't my idea to subject you to my deepest, most personal feelings about this time of year. I know better than that. A while ago, I was having lunch with my editor, who over the breadbasket turned to me, his youthful eyes filled with hope, and asked, "Any thoughts on a new book?" Right. Like I had been devoting all of my spare time to coming up with a concept for a book that would keep me chained to my desk for the next year, pining for a real life that was just outside my window. Not a one, I replied happily. Besides, I thought I'd brought book publishing to its knees with my last one. Ever since that book came out, your industry has been in a tailspin. Really? He asked. I thought that was the recession and the shifting technological landscape. Yes, he really does talk like that. Did you cause those too? By the way, can I have your breadstick? No, I want it. Besides, nobody reads anymore. People have no time for that kind of stuff. What's important now is a constant flow of vital information that one can access instantaneously. You know, like, who has a new blog? Christ, I hate that word. Or a new sex tape for sale. Are you sure you want that breadstick? For crying out loud. No one wants a whole book of thoughts or some fictional flight of fantasy. I continue as I crunch on a breadstick I don't want. People want things in real time. They want to know where to eat, to shop, to drink. They want it to be close. They want to know how to fucking get there. And if the phone would tell them who to fuck, they'd go and fuck them. And I mean that on all levels of the word. And they want to know right now, not by chapter 7. It could be too late by then. For God's sake, there are Twitter books. How can that even be? But it is. We are getting to the point where authors won't even have to write. They'll install a chip in their heads, and then you can go to whoever gets the technology first, and then you can just listen to the book as the author thinks it. Talk to me again about a book when you have a chip installed in this. I punctuated my point by pounding my head, which actually quieted the voices. Are you finished? My editor asked quietly. You're the one who's finished. Did you hurt yourself? He pressed on. Do I need to call somebody? What are you, a Boy Scout? No, I don't need anybody called. You insist on pounding your head like that. You're going to do damage. More damage than you've already done, I mean, he added. Never mind. It's like a pinball machine up there. I'm just whacking it to get it out of the tilt mode. I have an idea, he said. An idea? Are you kidding me? Seriously, ideas are the next thing to go. We are moving rapidly into a world of ideacons. They're like those stupid emoticons, only they pretend to express an idea. Just like you don't have to feel the emotion, pretty soon you won't have to be bothered by thinking either. Ooh, that's good. Save it for the page. The page? Are you talking about paper? You're killing me here. It's all going to be on a screen. It's still a book. What book? The one you should write about Christmas. Are you out of your fucking mind? A Christmas book based on all the memories I don't have of it? Because, lest you forget, I am a Jew. Lewis, Dickens was a Jew. No, he wasn't. He wanted to be. Not at Christmas time, he didn't. That's your book. That's not a book. It's barely a sentence. The voices in my head were starting to clear their throats again. Glenn Beck wrote a Christmas book. You've got to be kidding me. Called what? Santa's a Tubby Socialist, where Glenn analyzes why a fat man, dressed in red no less, distributes gifts to every single child to teach them the heinous act of sharing? I've got news for you. Santa doesn't bring anything for the Jewish kids because they already worship a socialist god of their own. I'm sure Glenn's even got a chapter about how President Obama believes in Santa more than the country he may or may not have been born in. Not even close, Lewis. But if Glenn Beck can write a book for Christmas, so can you. And as every mom used to say, if Glenn jumped off a roof, would you? Well, if I could get his publishing rights, I would. But I know you can write a better book about Christmas, Lewis. You son of a bitch, taunting me with Glenn Beck. If I can't write a better book than he does, I should jump off the roof. What makes you think I should write a book about Christmas? You've been Santa twice. They ask you to play Scrooge in a huge production of A Christmas Carol. Yes, you heard that correctly. Me is Scrooge. My career, dear listener, has been a strange one, with twists and turns as weird as anything cooked up by Stephen King or the writers of The Hills. But playing Scrooge, that was truly an odd one. As far as I know, no one I have known in my 40 years in the professional theater ever even considered the possibility of my playing Dickens' most famous Christmas hater. Or, if somebody had thought of the idea, he'd mentioned it to someone else, and the other person had died laughing. If the casting wasn't strange enough, the play's producers were offering me a small fortune to play the role in huge theaters around the country. The reason I mention that they were willing to pay me a bunch of money that felt to me like the kind of money you get in pro sports is that at the time, the economy was tanking. Badly. A Christmas Carol starring Lewis Black as Scrooge. It sounds like the producers were Bialy Stock and Bloom from The Producers. Theoretically, it makes a bit of sense. I mean, who better to play Scrooge than a bitter, angry Jew? As ludicrous as the whole idea was, it didn't stop me from picking up the script and looking at it. And who knew what might follow if it worked? Lewis Black as King Lear? Lewis Black as Macbeth? Lewis Black as Mama Rose in Gypsy? As I read, I was shocked to find out how big Scrooge's part is. Somehow I remembered it as just a bunch of humbugs with an occasional bah thrown in to spice things up. Nope. Ebenezer yaks a lot. More than is really necessary, to be honest. He goes on and on and on and on in order to show everybody what a prick he is. I might have had a stroke memorizing all that shit. Fortunately for my few remaining brain cells, the show never happened. The producers couldn't find a cast that could help me sell enough tickets for the thing to make financial sense. Which is why I'm sitting at lunch yelling at my editor about Glenn Beck. You know, I didn't end up playing Scrooge. And that's my fault? Come on, Lewis. This is better than being Scrooge. You can write about him. You can talk about how you would have been the definitive Scrooge. How you would have been remembered for your work. Like that actor Booth was. Because he killed Lincoln? No, the other one. Shirley, I think her name was. I wouldn't have been the definitive Scrooge. Then tell them why you would have been a lousy Scrooge. Tell them whatever you want. It's your book. I don't want to write another book. I don't have to write another book. Writing is hell. It's brutal. It's hours of sitting by myself in front of a piece of shit computer, spewing out my guts, and then dealing with you and your whiny editorial notes. You need a better joke here. I don't understand this paragraph. This doesn't make sense. I don't give whiny notes. All notes are whiny. Lewis, listen to me. If you write another book, the public might begin to believe you are a writer. Son of a bitch! Now he got me. I've always wanted to be known as a writer. It's why I went to graduate school, for crying out loud. And then I realized, this guy's not my editor. He's a crack dealer for my self-esteem. I don't know if I can do it. Of course you can. You're a writer. Stop it! It's like you're rubbing the inner thigh of my brain. Think about it. Take long walks. Let your mind run free. We'll have another lunch soon to talk about it some more. Another free lunch. God, I love free lunches. Okay. So now he's hooked me. How does he know I'll write a good book about the holidays when I didn't even think I could write another book? And why would I want to go through the tortures of the damned to finish it? I didn't take long walks, but I thought about it. And after a while, I told him that I couldn't write the kind of Christmas book that everyone else writes, and that even if I could, I wouldn't want to. Then I told him what I thought I might be able to write about. And you know what the idiot said? He said it's a book. I hope he's right, because here it is. A warning to the listener from the author. Before you proceed, I want you to know that for those of you who have a deep attachment to the season that runs from Thanksgiving to Christmas, or an emotional connection to stores that sell Christmas stuff all year round, don't read this book. This isn't where you want to be. I am telling you as a friend. Books that will make you piss eggnog and shit fruitcakes and gingerbread men and holly are everywhere. They surround you like Christmas music in the elevator. This has nothing to do with you, or with those of you for whom this holiday is one of the cornerstones you rest your life on. You'll just make harumphy noises when you hear it. You won't laugh, and you'll end up hating me. I don't need that. This is really for the rest of us. A couple more provisos. This book contains, like the celebration of Christmas, only 2% religion. Think of it as the Yuletide equivalent of low-fat milk. This book also contains what some people call profanity. I think they're full of shit. 'Tis the season. And so it begins anew each year, sometimes as early as August, or as late as just before Thanksgiving, off in the distance, we hear the faint sound of bells, a muffled drumbeat, and a barely audible choir humming in harmony. What are those sounds? They're the first sounds of Christmas, the carols that we can't wait to hear, and they will be played into oblivion until our eardrums rebel in rage, screaming for silence. And is that an elf I see? By George, it is. But for crying out loud, it's Labor Day. Whenever it starts, though, the Christmas season takes on a momentum all its own, like the running of the bulls. It stampedes through every street, in every town, in every shop, every home, and every life, careening through our every waking moment. If we could harness its power, we would never again have to argue about fossil fuels, or debate energy policy, or worry about our carbon ass print. As this is happening, we Jews stand back and watch in awe. We are like the spectators who stand outside the fence and watch those idiots who have chosen to run with the bulls. And like many of you Christians at Christmas time, the runners are drunk and not thinking clearly. You and they are both trying to find the courage to overcome the fear of being gored, either by a bull or by an emotional verbal hatchet thrown at you by a loved one. Why would you subject yourself to this kind of madness? Maybe that's why we Jews are called the chosen people, because we don't have to celebrate Christmas. We only have to compete with it, and we don't really even do that, as Hanukkah is proof that we just gave up. What's extraordinary about this time of year to me is that not only has this year's Christmas arrived, it's as if every other Christmas that has ever happened before came along too. The memory of every single one. And it's not even just your own Christmas memories. It's everybody's. Christmas during the Korean conflict. The Christmas truce of World War I. Christmas in Bucharest. Christmas during the Middle Ages. Christmas at the White House. The list is endless. And if that weren't enough, there are even fictional memories. White Christmas, the movie and the song. How the Grinch Stole Christmas. As I recall, that was some kind of hedge fund Ponzi scheme. A Very Brady Christmas. Or Norman Rockwell's compendium of Christmastime paintings and magazine covers that made every American look as if they were made of cream cheese. So many Christmas memories to contend with. So little time and emotional wherewithal to deal with them. It's an overload. Christmas isn't a holiday. It's an emotional tsunami that hits you with waves of tinsel that engulf you until you have drowned in a sea of good cheer. Every year, all of that unimaginable pressure of finding just the right gift, of seeing everybody in the family, of putting up the decorations, writing the Christmas cards, selecting the perfect tree, and decorating it just so, the endless lists of lists of lists. It's unbelievable. And it's extraordinary to watch. Whenever I have celebrated the holiday in the homes of others, there's a feeling that hangs over the event that this Christmas has to be the best one ever. The most ideal, the one like that Christmas when you were young and the world seemed so sweet and you were so innocent. To get back to that time that once was, but really never was what you thought it was, because it wasn't like that. It was just another Christmas and all that entails. As I'm a Jew, one would think I could easily escape this maelstrom. But I never do. No one can. No one is immune from the all-consuming madness. There is something that stirs deep within me as Christmas approaches. As the days tick by, an oral wall of carols is erected around me. The advertising on radio, television, and the web becomes one long primal scream of sales beyond human comprehension. The holiday films flicker deep into my psyche, and the Christmas cards roll in, and with them, the long, laborious notes that share the joys and triumphs of the many brilliant offspring of my friends and acquaintances. This is followed by a litany of diseases wrestled with over the past year. The pets that have passed on. The minute descriptions of wondrous vacations. The occasional work promotion. All of which ends with the usual conclusion that we really need to see each other more often. Like before we drop dead or something. The most extraordinary card I ever received was a picture of a family, and I had absolutely no idea of who they were. Not a one. The signature gave no clue, as it was illegible. I went through the Rolodex in my skull and came up with nothing. Who the fuck are the people in this photo, and why are they so happy to see me? What kind of an asshole am I that I can no longer remember close friends? No, please, dear God, don't let it be early-onset Alzheimer's. I put the picture up on my bathroom mirror and studied it every day. Maybe his hair changed color. Or maybe I know the woman from some long-past drug-induced bacchanal. People just don't send these cards out willy-nilly. Maybe that's who they are, willy and nilly. Every day I was reminded that I had a very special friend, and that I had consigned whoever it was to some dustbin in my brain. I was taunted and tortured by the photo. Until, that is, one day when I'm in my agent's office in Los Angeles, and the very old friend walks into the office I'm sitting in. Jesus! He wasn't an old friend at all. He was an agent. An agent I had met exactly once before, and his name had both a wine and a stein in it, and that was the most disturbing part of the whole episode. I received a Christmas card marking the birth of the Christ from a fellow Jew, whom I barely knew. That's when I learned a valuable lesson. Never underestimate the power of a Christmas card. As I have grown older, in the midst of all of these stimuli, I find myself getting sadder and sadder. Yet the sadness is oddly comforting, as the memories flow in of my brother and the many friends with whom I spent these holiday times, but are no longer with us. For in the midst of the sense of loss and the tears, these times remembered bring a sense of joy. For some inexplicable reason, these memories are conjured up by the Christmas season, though they have nothing at all to do with the holiday. Go figure. At this time of year, I find myself falling into a condition that I like to call infectious romanticus, or sentimentalicus irrationalico. I find Christians suffer from the same condition during this time of year. The difference is, I have no remote connection to Christmas, other than as a spectator. I shall repeat. I am a Jew. I may have been brought into Christian households to celebrate the festivities, but I am not a part of them. Christians don't seem to get why we Jews don't just embrace Christmas. Well, it's because we don't buy the story. We don't believe a special infant was born and that he was the Son of God. And that story is the reason all of you Christians aren't Jews. So we're put off a little by all of the hoopla, which is perfectly understandable when you people do it, but it still makes us cringe a little. Which makes it all the more strange that during this season, I am drowning in sentimentality just like any Christian. I will choke up while watching a commercial where a father and son argue over a cell phone plan. Tears come as a mother talks to the camera about the extraordinary power of a cleansing detergent. Coke celebrates the Christmas season with images of traditional Christmases, or Santa placing gifts under a tree, and I am incapable of getting out of my chair for a good 5 minutes. Someone as emotionally detached from the world as I usually am finds himself awash in emotions generally found only in movies with Jimmy Stewart in them. I am drenched in a romantic sense of life that I don't even believe in. As happy as I am with my life, happy might be a stretch, but I do like my life, colonoscopies not included, I somehow feel that something indefinable has passed me by. I am an outsider to the grand scheme of things. I am alone. Sure, I have friends, lots of them, and I have the Christmas cards to prove it. But most of them are raising families. They have real lives. I know I have a real life, too, but theirs seem realer. They have normal lives. I have a tour bus. Where is my wife? Where is my family? That's what we were all programmed for. How the fuck did I miss the programming? Where is my really real life? The question rarely occurs to me. But at Christmas time, it pounds relentlessly on my psyche, my conscience, and my frontal lobes, or the back ones I can never remember because of all the pounding. I dream of girlfriends past, of girlfriends present, and girlfriends future. It's as if I am Scrooge, but instead of being a miserly prick, I am emotionally withdrawn and inept at relationships, and the ghosts of my ex-girlfriends take me through our times together and remind me of the wondrous joys and warmth and fulfillment of the loves we shared. They then present to me a vision of the extraordinary children we would have had and how rich our family life together would have been. They then dance around me, as achingly beautiful as I remember each of them, as they sing like a chorus of angels. Shithead, shithead, Lou, you really stink. You have nothing left except your stinky stink. And before I awaken, I am naked on a promontory as the wind howls and the vultures pick the meat off my bones. Needless to say, I awaken with a start. Where did I go wrong? Every Christmas, I feel that I must now mate and have a family, or else all of my time on this planet has been for naught. I realize this is totally irrational, as if I am awash in the hormones produced by a romance novel, or the film version of The Gift of the Magi. In the end, my Christmas is not about Christmas. It's about me. I spend it rattling down the corridors of my mind, jiggling the knobs on imaginary locked doors, behind which just might be all the answers I've spent a lifetime desperately searching for, wondering how I ended up becoming me. Just me. By myself. Alone. Let me show you what I mean. Thanksgiving. I hear the peaceful sounds of waves doing their dance on the beach as I bask in a sun that seems just a little too close to the earth today. Birds are twittering. Birds twitter. Humans shouldn't. Trust me, it's a law of nature, number 7, I think. Occasionally, I hear the piercing cry of a seabird, that sits in a tree a few feet from my chaise lounge. I am reading George Carlin's final book, Last Words. I am enjoying it. I am enjoying where I'm sitting, too. I am at peace. It's Thanksgiving, and I am far away from home, literally and figuratively. I am in Costa Rica. That's right. You heard that correctly. I was in Costa Rica during a major American holiday. What can I say? I'm a rebel. Besides, where else would one spend Thanksgiving? But why Costa Rica, you ask? Why would I leave my native land as the days get shorter and shorter, the weather gets crummier and crummier, and the world gets crazier and crazier? For years, my friend Neil and I have chosen to leave the United States for an annual vacation. This all began about 10 years ago, when we both realized we were raging workaholics and we desperately needed to set aside a few days each year to ensure that we got a break of some sort. But why Thanksgiving, you ask? Isn't it the beginning of the holiday season? Isn't this the time to sit around the hearth, if one has a hearth, with one's family, if one has a family, in order to refresh the warmth of your blood ties and bonds? Not if your mothers can't cook. When your mother has no concept of how to cook a turkey, let alone the mashed potatoes, the stuffing, the gravy, the cranberry sauce, the green vegetables, the apple, and the pumpkin pies. And as a kid, you can see your folks hoping someone will invite your family over for Thanksgiving dinner so that your mother doesn't have to cook. You learn pretty quickly that at Thanksgiving, it's time to get the fuck out of Dodge. I can remember the last Thanksgiving I spent in the United States. I went with Neil and his lovely wife, Lori, who has since passed on, to have Thanksgiving dinner at Neil's parents' house. Neil always said that his mother could go head-to-head with mine in a gastronomic demolition derby. And he was right. Neil's mother prepared a meal that was just as unbelievable as my mother's cooking. I knew then that we were moments away from a reality show I'm sure would be a huge success. We could call it, What the Fuck Am I Eating? Hey, if there's a show called I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant, or, as I like to call it, Jesus Christ, Am I an Idiot or What?, then my cooking show idea could certainly work. But back to the two mothers. That something potentially mouth-watering could be put in the oven and come out as the illusion of food is a trick few cooks can pull off. In short, Neil's mother and mine completely redefined the definition of cooking. The joy of these kind of meals, such as there is in the chewing. There is barely any taste. And aroma? Don't make me laugh. A turkey done until it has been sapped of any moisture, as if it was created from the dust of the Kalahari, has no scent to it at all. It is as if killing the turkey the first time wasn't enough. Cooks of this particular caliber don't even want the memory of its potential deliciousness to linger. But at least the turkey didn't suffer alone. It had plenty of company. There were potatoes screaming for gravy that never made it to the table due to some hideous kitchen accident. And the green beans seemed to be weeping as if they wished to return to the field of their birth, hoping for a fresh start. In truth, I can't remember the rest of the meal. I believe I have repressed the memory of it. But Neil was right. His mother, in her own fashion, had created a meal that I thought only my mother could have laid waste to. You hate to talk about your mother's cooking this way, but it's this kind of consistently bad holiday cooking that made us flee the country on a national holiday, as if we were warned that we were about to be hit by a natural catastrophe, only ours was man-made, and disconcertingly taking place in our mother's kitchens. But a twice-killed bird is not the only reason I have an aversion to what should be my day of thanks. As wonderful as so many find Christmas, it still hits us with the force of a hurricane, as it begins with a vengeance at Thanksgiving. And then, there it is, 24 hours a day, as we are pounded relentlessly with music and advertising and everything that tradition and history and media can throw at us. Thanksgiving is the beginning of a relentless assault on our senses. To leave then and return after the high winds of marketing have begun to settle down just a little bit makes a lot of sense to me. As a bonus, the people around you have gotten over the initial trauma. So by going out of the country at Thanksgiving, you escape the first week of Christmas, which feels like a year by my calendar. And that only leaves you with another 4 years left before you finally stumble to the 25th of December. Getting out of town at Thanksgiving makes Christmas time a hell of a lot easier for me. So, here I am in Central America, far from the maddening crowds. I lean back in my chair. I close my eyes and embrace the serenity. Yes, you heard me right. There is serenity and tranquility, and above all else, peace. Commodities I have so little of in my life. It takes me a little while to get used to, as at first it's a bit unsettling and unnerving. But I finally let myself go, as the voices inside my skull drift into the sweet silence that envelops me. And then, as the novelist Thomas Pynchon so aptly wrote, a screaming comes across the sky. It pierces through my fragile sense of well-being that was nestling into me and rends the very fabric of existence with its insistent wail. What is that ungodly and inhuman cacophony? It's a child. A child whose lungs are bursting through its mouth in a cry of high-pitched demand and need not heard before in the history of the human species. And no, it is not my inner child, which on occasion has been heard to wail in my soul like a banshee. A kid! Are you kidding me? We are in the middle of paradise. I'm just about to do something I've almost forgotten how to do. Relax. When out of the blue, there appears this lovely, precious bundle of joy with a name like Tucker or Skip or Pip. Why is he screaming? What more can he need in life? Is the perfection that surrounds him not enough? Of course it isn't. What does he know of perfection? He's 3 years old, for fuck's sake. He has needs that perfection can't fulfill. This kid has deep-seated needs. He needs to know with absolute certainty that he has an effect on those around him. This is just one of the hundreds of tests that Pip must run daily so he can mature into the kind of human being who will enjoy and appreciate this heaven on earth. When he is fucking old enough to enjoy it. Well, apparently, that's not going to happen in the next 5 minutes. So for God's sake, Would one of his parents get him a milkshake, a fluffy towel, a sleeping pill, whatever? Anything to shut him the fuck up. He's killing my sense of bliss. And I rarely, if ever, feel bliss. Or what I think bliss is. Then I look around. Jesus Christ. This joint is crawling with kids. You gotta be kidding me. This has gotta be some grand cosmic joke. Someone has gotta be laughing about this somewhere in the universe, and that someone doesn't seem to give a shit about me. It took me my entire life to be able to afford to come to a place like this, and also not feel guilty about doing so. At long last, I've found somewhere where I could rest my weary bones before returning to the madness. I am extraordinarily blessed to be here, and I know it. But does that 3-year-old actually need to take time off? And if so, from what, pray tell? Potty training? Was Pip seeking solitude? A haven from the insanity of life in playgroup back in the U.S.? Was his anguish at home so deep that, frothing at the mouth, he threw a fit so violent that the kitty ended up dead in the toilet, its fur ripped from its body? Did his parents at that point turn to each other and sigh? I don't think that counseling is really doing the job for our little darling. It doesn't seem to be spot on. Forget the experts. I think what Pip really needs is a tropical vacation. And unfortunately, it's not just Pip. There are kids of every size, shape, and description crawling all over the place, with nannies akimbo. And what is that in the little bundle? Oh, is it? Oh, for God's sake, infants! They've even brought infants. To what end? For what purpose? Why? By gracing you with that precious gift, wasn't God sending you a deeper message? Were these parents not listening when God proclaimed to the newborn and his family, "For every season there is a purpose, and now is the time for you to nurture your little baby in a bubble of love of your own creation, in the house you have chosen to live, in order for that baby not to have to undergo the horrifying vagaries of aircraft cabin pressure at 35,000 feet, which can wreak such havoc on his barely formed inner ears." Let me see if I can put it more succinctly. Stay home, idiots! And did these people ever consider what a tropical climate might do to their baby? A baby that has barely adjusted to the climate of his or her own hometown, I might add. Have these parents no fear that their pride and joy might contract some sort of inscrutable and incurable skin rash? I know that I'm worried about waking up to find my body covered with red splotches outlined in white with a star in the middle. I don't know what it might be, but I know it's serious. If I'm scared, shouldn't these parents fear for the well-being of their darlings too? Of course they should. But they're too busy sunning themselves near the pool while playing the latest app on their iPhone to realize this. Some might say, I am overreacting, that I'm being overprotective of the infant. Bullshit. I'm not. I'm being overprotective of myself. I don't want babies on my vacation. Besides, it's Thanksgiving. Shouldn't they all be at home where they belong? For God's sake, it's the beginning of the holiday season. Where are these families' family values? A child needs memories of the family together as Dad slices the turkey, their brothers and sisters arguing spiritedly about who gets the remote control during the Macy's Day Parade, their uncles snoring through the football game as their aunts gossip after dinner. They need to witness the alcohol, the rage, the tears of regret, things that can sink deeply into their barely formed psyches and scar them forever. Otherwise, what are they going to talk to their shrinks about? Trust me, I know what I'm talking about. Since my family rarely celebrated our own Thanksgiving, I am nearly bereft of family values of any sort. But that's a whole other set of problems and a whole other book. But there are little tics I have because of Thanksgivings I spent with other families when I was growing up. For example, I weep whenever anyone brings out a gravy boat with real gravy. Or I hear angry screams whenever I see a bottle of Old Crow bourbon. The only good thing one can say about giving a child who can barely speak a Thanksgiving in a tropical resort is that it's not an Al-Qaeda Thanksgiving. There's no chance the kids will ask, "Daddy, why is the turkey ticking?" When the children aren't going off half-cocked outdoors, they're going off half-cocked indoors. I sadly learned there is no separate dining room for them. From the breakfast buffet to fine dining at dinner, the kids are flittering around the place or staring blankly at their portobello mushroom quiches with gruyere and crab just before they burst into tears and begin shrieking that they hate it. They even have their own breakfast buffet line, where they can be assured of mainlining enough sugar to keep them rocketing through space till the sun goes down. Even though I hate to swim, I tried going to the adult pool to escape the madness and calm my nerves. Unfortunately, I discovered that the adult pool was much smaller than the main pool, and that only fueled my rage. Is this a joke? As a kid, I always got the fucking small pool, the waiting pool in the backyard. And now as an adult, I still get the small pool, while the kids get the big pool? Why, those little fuckers, it's just not right! To me, this hotel has to be a place for adults, and maybe, just maybe, and very grudgingly, teenagers. But children? No! It's for romantic getaways, or to just get away from it all. And the all in getting away from it all definitely includes children, who, I repeat, don't need to get away from anything. If these parents can afford an overpriced vacation for themselves and their four children and the nanny during the holidays, maybe they could put their money to better use. How about paying more taxes? Maybe their taxes need to be raised a little. Is this why we refuse to raise taxes on the wealthy? So they have enough money to let their bratty little kids soak up the Costa Rica sun? Really? Fuck them! Too harsh, you think? So we all should just say, fuck the infrastructure. Fuck the returning soldier. Fuck the emergency we can't imagine just past the tanning butter. I say fuck that. I can hear you now. But, Lewis, you're enjoying a vacation, too. Aren't you lounging in the tropical sun? I know. And I admit, I feel a little guilty about being here by myself. But I also think that the government needs to raise my taxes so I don't go to these places, and therefore don't feel guilty. All I'm saying is at times like these, you can tax the rich a little more. Don't cry. I said a little. God knows you wouldn't want to take too much from the rich, because even though they'd still be rich, they wouldn't be as rich. And maybe they'd have to stay at home at Thanksgiving with the kids instead of unleashing them on me. Look, I don't mean to be unduly rude, but I have to be. I have been left with no choice. Thanksgiving isn't a family time for me, so much so that I literally flee the country. And I really, really don't want to spend my few days of peace with yours. This type of holiday family gathering at a tropical resort was once the province of only the super rich. We are talking the Astors, the Fricks, the Kennedys, the Fords, the Houdahas, and the honorable their shit never smells. All the big families of note. The reason they went off for the holidays was so they could all gather together and count their money with families of like social status, and make sure they married within their class, their very upper, upper class. This assured that they kept all the money to themselves. These vacations were a way to introduce their children to the entitlement they felt they so richly deserved. Okay, maybe I exaggerate here, just a little. But these kids in Costa Rica with me are not Fricks, or Fords, or Houdahadas. And as they sit on the beach before me, taking a vacation like this, sucking on the little coconut mango smoothies the hotel staff passes around when the sun is at its peak, I can't help wondering what this kind of extraordinary experience is going to do to their young minds. What the fuck are they going to expect as adults? I understand. It's not their fault that their parents are wealthy, self-indulgent idiots who don't want their child suffering the indignities of a holiday in off the interstate the way they had to when they were kids. So, when I look at the children frolicking in the spectacularly blue ocean in front of me, I am not looking at America's future. I am seeing tomorrow's basket cases, the people who have changed their name to Tush Tush, or Cum Squash, or Poached, in order to stand out from the crowd, and who will never be noticed for their talents or accomplishments, but for their massively narcissistic egos. I am looking at the next generation's Paris Hiltons and Kardashian kids, and the motley collection of morons from whatever new reality shows are going to induce nausea in me in the future. Of course, every one of these kids scampering across the sandy beach won't end up like them. But I can guarantee that a lot of them will. We are spawning another generation that feels that the world around them exists only for the sake of their own egos. Egos that grow like a rapidly advancing cancer that will engulf and consume us in whatever medium is the next carrier of the images that surround us. These are the egos that will create tomorrow's world, and sadly, these are the egos that will believe that they are more important than the world in which they exist. Jesus, that's bleak, you think. It can't be that bad, Lewis. Besides, who are you to be standing in judgment of these people? I take your point. I am down here among the privileged during the worst economic downturn of my lifetime. I am the little pig going back for the third time to the breakfast buffet while many of my countrymen are going without breakfast at all. I am screaming about these kids, but truth be told, I am the irresponsible one in this whole scenario. I am the one who should know better. I should be out with Habitat for Humanity. Only I am worthless with tools. but I should at least be putting my money where my mouth is. Okay, I admit it. I am a piece of shit. But I am a piece of shit trying to relax on a beach. I don't need these kind of thoughts racing through my brain while I'm supposed to be on vacation. I will be home soon enough, where I can properly berate and loathe myself in the quiet solitude of my own apartment. So thank God I have more than one voice in my head. There is another country to be heard from. Forget about tomorrow, Lewis. You've got some sort of native rum concoction in front of you. And there are the notes of some Costa Rican love song lingering in the air. You're not standing knee-deep in the rising tide of the Christmas onslaught. And you deserve a rest. That's why you're having these crazy thoughts. Really, everything is going to be just fine. Just the way God and your accountant planned it. God, what is that? Is that a retching sound I hear? Oh, Jesus, little Pip is throwing up. Too much sun, I guess. I can hear my shrink now. And when did you lose your ability to empathize with others, Lewis? This past Thanksgiving, I will reply. Do you want to talk about it? I'm not ready. I'm still enjoying it. I turn to Neil and his wife, Machiko. He is remarried, and now the three of us go on these trips together. It's been a great vacation, I say. I almost believe it. We leave tomorrow, and I haven't been upgraded to first class. But I can handle it. Unless Pip is sitting in a first-class seat. And of course he was. You know what a 3-year-old needs most is ample legroom and free cocktails. To me, he's a little shit. And it's not even his fault. It's mine. It was a long trip. I took a short nap. We landed. We went through immigration. I was home. And the Christmas season had arrived. With a vengeance. I was ready for it. I had girded my loins through epic battles with Pip. I would let the Christmas madness pass over me like all of those warm Costa Rican breezes. And I didn't miss the turkey dinner. It was easier to handle Pip than my mother's Thanksgiving meal. Pip had also taught me an important lesson. I learned maybe it was a good thing I didn't have any children. And the no kids thing certainly cuts down on my Christmas shopping. The hooker at Rockefeller Center. It is as hard for me to escape the Christmas season as it is for me to forget about sex. I mean, it does seem to me that the popular culture and advertising spend an awful lot of time and money to remind my psyche that the season of Santa is upon me every year. Those same forces spend the same time and money talking to my penis. Between the two, my penis listens more often. Let's face it. If it's not the display of boobage in order to entice me toward drinking a certain beer, it's the boner pills, the hair gel or body spray that gets you laid. And all these messages are transmitted before I even make it to my morning coffee. So while my penis pays close attention to everything, my psyche sometimes wanders. It's a problem I'm dealing with. But whenever I actually forget for a few moments that it's Christmas time, the tree at Rockefeller Center, much like a hooker working her favorite spot, is there to remind me. I admit that there is something magical about a Christmas tree all dazzled up in lights. It's almost as breathtaking as a hooker gone wild in spangles. It gets to me. Maybe it's just that having a Christmas tree makes a living room just a little cozier. But I think it goes deeper than that. Maybe it's the sense of rebirth that the lights give to a very dead or very artificial tree. In the midst of winter, when a pall hangs heavy in the frozen gray air, these glittering reminders of holiday cheer can be downright comforting. I have to say, the same can be said about a hooker.